Thank you, George. We're going to have a time for questions now, and there'll be two roving mics, one on the side, one on the side. So you need to just put your hand up straight in the air so that the microphone can be passed along to you, and George will field questions. I might get the ball rolling. George, you mentioned that the Bible is a lot more than history in the sense that you described. Is it any less?
No, I don't think it's less. I think many scholars that I've read and many of whom I've conversed with will say that the artistic form of the Bible means that history is hidden. We can't actually access history because of the artistic form of the Bible, and I don't believe that's the case. Certainly, I think the artistry of the Bible is part of the art of persuasion of the Bible, and part of the theology of the Bible is that God interacted with real people at real times in real places. And that, I think, is part of the message, but it's not the entirety of the message. There is more to it than simply these things happened. The significance of these things is often unpacked. So the way I would put it is the artistic qualities of the Bible, while some would claim that they in some way obscure history, I would say that they actually reveal theology, and part of the theology is to confirm that certain things happened.
Would the things that you've been saying apply as much in the New Testament, or is there more historical evidence for events in the New Testament?
Thank you. There is a lot more evidence for events in the New Testament. The general rule is the later it is, the more evidence we have for it. The Greco-Roman era was one where we have so much preserved. The era of David, we don't have a lot. So there is a massive difference in terms of the amount of evidence we have. Having said that, we do need to realise that the New Testament as well does have artistic qualities, but the New Testament is also largely, is starting to, well, it is imbibing the Greek historical tradition, which is a big step closer towards the way we do history than, say, what we have in the Old Testament. So part of the point of the Gospels is to persuade someone. So, for example, John's Gospel has a purpose statement. These things are written that you may believe that the Christ is Jesus. There is that persuasive element there. But the persuasive element is, as far as the Gospels are concerned, this is what happened. Listen and learn what actually happened. So there is... There certainly is that artistic element there in the New Testament, but the Greek historical tradition pushes us a lot closer to the way we do history today than what, say, we encounter in the Old Testament. It's not fully where we are, having said that. It's not right, you know, the way that we do history today. There are some key differences, I think, still, but it's certainly a lot closer than what we have in the Old Testament.
Thanks, George. Byron Smith here. Thanks for a fascinating lecture. My question relates to the contemporary political context of archaeology in Jerusalem that you alluded to at the end. I'm just trying to understand it a bit better. You implied that much of the archaeology that happens is funded by the Israeli government. Is there any archaeology happening in Jerusalem conducted by Palestinians? If so, what sort of proportion would it be?
Thank you for the question. The Israeli government does fund some archaeological excavations throughout Israel, particularly through the Israeli Antiquities Authority. The organisation I referred to was an independent organisation, the City of David Foundation. They describe themselves as a Zionist organisation seeking to promote Jewish settlement in the land of Israel. And once you understand that particular agenda, you can understand the connection that they have to archaeological excavations. They don't fund many archaeological excavations, but the key ones in Jerusalem, where we desperately want to dig, they are the ones who are funding those particular excavations. So there, It's not surprising that the archaeologists excavating with the funding from the City of David Foundation tends to come out with largely pro-Israelite understandings of the archaeological record. The Palestinians are slowly getting their excavations done, but they are certainly way behind, largely through lack of funding and lack of infrastructure. There has also been significant dispute as to where people can excavate, who has authority to determine who can excavate where. Exactly where the borders fall in that part of the world is very much disputed. It's an ongoing dispute. So that also has to be factored in.
George, I was wondering when your doctoral research was published and how it's being picked up internationally, especially by evangelical scholars. Are they receiving it well?
My thesis was published in 2003. The original reviews were mixed. There were two particular reviews that panned it. And I'm sorry to say that I can tell by the reviews that the reviewers didn't actually read the book. On page one, for example, I suggest that coming to a conclusion about any inscription, but especially the Tel Dan inscription, has to be reached on a physical examination of the actual fragments themselves rather than based on photographs or drawings of the inscription. So that's why I was so surprised when I went to Jerusalem and had a look at the inscription. There was this extra letter. It simply didn't appear on the photographs or in the drawings. And one particular reviewer, who is a very prominent Israeli archaeologist, said, there is no extra letter there. It doesn't appear on the photos or in the drawings. It's obviously missed page one. One other reviewer panned it as... characterised me as a minimalist, someone who describes the Bible as useless for the purposes of history, and quotes me. The problem is he quotes me where I'm quoting a minimalist. And in the next paragraph is where I refute the paragraph by the minimalist. So again, he's just cherry-picked certain things, and you can tell that he hasn't read it. Those who did read it all the way through actually had glowing reviews. So it's been well received. However, the consensus view still prevails. One of my purposes in life is to go to the major conferences where archaeologists and epigraphers gather together, and whenever the Tel Dan inscription comes up, mention. There is an extra letter, folks, that changes everything. And so I'll keep doing that, and more people are starting to become aware of it.
Hi, George. Thanks again. So you've said we don't want to go with a Bible in our hands, but you've also said we want to go here, and it's primarily because the Bible drives us to go here. And there are lots of places where we'd love to have evidence for what actually happened in Exodus, for example, because otherwise the competing theories of, you know, Amphictyones or whatever, that's just as viable an option. And with David, you have different Davids. And until we find further evidence of David, what is there to say? It's not just different literary ideas of different kingly figures. You know, one's a brave shepherd, one's a nice harp-playing guy who lives in the palace. You know, there are different ideas. Until we find stuff that we're driven to with our Bibles, how are we to get closer to actually knowing that? There's a few questions.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. The motivation for digging certainly comes from the Bible for many people. But it's one thing to be motivated by the Bible. That is, many people have a faith commitment, be that Christian or Jewish, or they just have a particular interest. This is their interest. And so they are motivated by the Bible to go and excavate in Israel and Palestine and Jordan. But that doesn't mean the process of excavation should occur with the Bible in one hand and the spade in the other. The process of interpreting finds, I think, needs to be done independently so that we have as objective as possible a view of the evidence. And as I said, evidence doesn't naturally suggest itself in one particular interpretation. There are a number of interpretations that can be suggested, but we need to see the range of interpretations that are possible. They need to be on the table first. After that point, we might then turn to the Bible and say, well, the Bible would fit this interpretation at that point. So we would say, well, we favour that interpretation for that reason. And we need to be upfront about that. So we shouldn't pretend that we're not trying to make a correspondence with what we see in the Bible, particularly if we're motivated to go digging in the first place by the Bible. We should be rather upfront with that rather than trying to hide that. But the consulting the Bible, I think, is the last step. The archaeological process itself, I think, needs to go ahead without the Bible, and then we come back and see what the Bible has to say about it. There's also down the front here too.
I'm here as a geologist interested in archaeology. You've referred to the Tel Den stone as a stele.
Yes.
A stone and also a brick. Is it actually synthetic? Is it a brick-like material?
No, it's basalt.
It's basalt?
Yes, it's volcanic rock.
How do you explain the fact that B1 has two extremely straight edges on it on the face, but when you look at the broken surface, the surface is rough. It looks like it's been struck with a very well-machined steel tool. Is that compatible with the culture that's supposed to have overthrown the people who made the inscription? See, that it's not quite a right angle, but those two edges are extremely straight, yet the broken surface behind the face is rough.
That's right, yeah. If
you had a normal break, like someone hit it with a hammer, the edges would be... they would not be straight if the faces that are broken aren't straight.
Yeah. It all depends on how the fragment itself fragments, how the stone itself falls, so the physical forces that are involved, as well as what pieces come off how they come off. I think what we see here, there, is probably the telltale signs of a sledgehammer. That broke the actual steeling. The straight edges I think you're talking about are the ones here, along that edge and then that edge there. Yeah. The other thing to mention here is that the exposed surface here is actually very thin. The angle between those exposed surfaces and the surface here is very slight. It appears to be quite a deep thing here in the photograph, but it's actually very, very slight. The fragment itself is quite thin. It's not very deep itself. So the fragmentation has just simply, you know, occurred in this particular way. They do seem to be natural breaks. There's nothing that seems to suggest tools into the exposed surfaces. They do seem to be quite natural. Yeah.
Thanks. Hank, do you mind just going back to the question on what is history, like our perceptions of history, just for a moment?
This one?
No. You had the questions we ask as modern historians,
yeah.
And questions that...
the ancients asked.
Yeah, the motivations for writing our histories. I'm particularly thinking about the question that we have now, whether Joseph existed, whether Moses and the Exodus happened, and you know, throughout the Old Testament of the Bible, what significance is this in the way that we... communicate the gospel to both Christians and non-Christians? And I'm also particularly thinking of, you know, the issues with Genesis, the issues with, you know, our how we interpret reality in the past.
I think in order to fully appreciate the way the ancients did history, we have to look at the songs that we sing in church. The songs that we sing in church are often looking back at particular biblical things, and we express them in creative ways. Let me give you an example. Behold the man upon a cross, my sin upon his shoulders. Ashamed, I hear my mocking voice cry out among the scoffers. Now, it might be a familiar song to many of you. I sang that last week wholeheartedly. Now, if you think about the words, what it's saying is, I was there at the cross calling out with scoffers. Historically, I wasn't. You could prove pretty much historically that I was not there. And yet, I am expressing a very deep theological and historical truth that this man, Jesus, who died 2,000 years ago outside the walls of Jerusalem, was dying for my sin. And what I've done is I've created something in this song, something of a scene, for want of a better word, that gives expression to the significance of this event to me. The biblical narratives do that as well. And they do it within the narrative itself, rather than simply tell us what happened and then at the end of it give us an appendix with a series of propositional statements that we can now believe as a result. Those propositional statements are elements of the narrative themselves, the narratives themselves. So they have been creatively woven into the narratives in order to show those particular things. And this is very common, I think, throughout the Old Testament, to varying degrees, but I think it's very common throughout the Old Testament. Now, I'm not sure if I've answered all of your question there. Yep.
The reliability of the Bible.
Yes.
And, you know, we're trying to weigh up the debates about whether it's evolution and
yep.
Genesis or even, you know, Moses and the Exodus.
Yep.
Are these good events? So for someone who doesn't believe in the Bible at all, they might say, well, the whole thing's made up.
Yep.
These things didn't happen, therefore. So what I'm thinking of, how can we use, you know, these different questions, it's why you're thinking. Both
absolutely, yes.
Non-believers, but also, I think, to
believe with different views. Yes. These questions, I think, understanding these questions, are pivotal to understanding the nature of the biblical documents. Because we are products of our environment in ways that we are often unaware. In particular, the kinds of questions that we expect the Bible to be answering. They are the questions that we would ask, but it's not necessarily the questions that ancient people would ask. So understanding what questions they were asking helps us to figure out what exactly we have in our hands when we are reading the Bible. It also helps us, I think, to understand the theological task of reading the Bible. Understanding the theology of the Bible is a necessary step in interpreting it. Because these are theological documents. They are making claims about God. Understanding what those claims are, I think, enables us to then say, to determine whether part of the message is, this happened. For certain things, I think that is part of the message. I think we can say it to varying degrees at various parts. So, for example, does it matter that Jesus was crucified and does it matter that he rose from the dead? Yes, part of the theological message of the Bible is that this actually happened. Let me pick another one, the case of the Exodus. To use a statement by one particular scholar, John Goldingay, if God is not the God who brought Israel up out of Egypt, I do not know who this God is. So understanding the theological purpose of the documents helps us, I think, to discern the historical claims of these particular documents. But in doing that, we mustn't then jettison the artistic qualities of the Bible. The biblical documents do not stop being art once we understand their historical purpose. But I think we only really get to the historical purpose when we ask the theological questions too. Now, there was a question down the front here.
Dr. George, thank you very much for tonight. I ask this question because you are obviously an expert and confined to this area, whereas I'm not. And so I ask this question because moving around, you'd see if what I'm going to mention now appeals to people who may or may not go to church or have a Christian belief. It's concerning... We've been looking at stones, lists, or whatever you like to really say about this. But can we also add to that people or personalities where there is quite a weight in the personality. To this one, the specific thing is that when the Pharisees and the Sadducees came to Jesus to question his messiahship, in other words, that he came from Judah, the fourth son of Jacob, and from the Judah who said, well, let's not kill this brother of ours. We can sell him and get some money, and we'll be richer than if we just kill him. Anyway, they said and questioned him about his messiahship, and he said, well, I'll answer your question if you answer mine. What did David mean when he said, the Lord said to my Lord? And they knew that he was talking about David, this entire group of religious men. And they said, well, they didn't want to put themselves in. We don't know. He said, well, neither do I answer, or we cannot answer your question, neither do I answer yours. Is it acceptable to go sideways from stone to members of the tribes of Jacob and single out Judah and the descendants of Judah to David, who had the scepter, to Jesus, and prove that David was part, an essential part of the dynasty?
We can do that in the biblical documents. In terms of historical process, I'm not sure we have all that much to go on. We do have references from the Assyrians to the kingdom of Judah, and they refer to it as Judah. We mustn't mustn't make that logical fallacy that because we see one point of intersection that implies necessarily everything. So what did the Assyrians mean by Judah? To them, Judah was just probably a name. It probably didn't have the patriarchal freight attached to it that we see in the Bible. For them, it was just simply a label of that's what that kingdom in that corner of the world calls themselves. So I'd be very careful about how much we make of things in the historical record. In the biblical record, we make those kinds of connections. And certainly with David, I think one of the theological pillars of the Old Testament is the existence of David. If there is no David, we have a massive theological hole that is very difficult to fill, and I think we fall into that hole if there is no David. So I think the theological message of David allows us to make that conclusion. We can then, on the basis of the Bible, connect David, you know, to further history back in Israel itself. But we can't necessarily do that with the historical record outside the Bible. Those kinds of corroborations, I would love it if we found them, but we simply don't have them. And in terms of inscriptions in Israel, inscriptions are the gold of archaeologists. Archaeologists find stones and pottery aplenty. Inscriptions are gold. When they come across it, it's, you know, the heavens shout for joy, as it were. So, you know, the Tel Dan inscription caused quite a fuss when it was found, but we haven't found all that much inscriptional evidence from within Israel itself. I'm not sure if I'm answering all of your question. No, that's right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. No, the Tel Dan inscription will not necessarily. It may, but I wouldn't depend on it leading people to the kingdom of God. God can use many means, and you know, if God can, you know, speak through the mouth of a donkey, then he could certainly use a stone. Certainly, but. This is why the biblical documents are so important. They are revelatory literature. God has sanctified these documents to be the ones that reveal himself and his character. He hasn't simply made history itself generally the revelation of himself. If that were the case, if we found the, for example, the memoirs of Pilate or the records of Pontius Pilate on the day that Jesus was tried by him, would we pop those into our New Testament canon? Well, I'd say no, because they're not revelatory literature. And the concept of inspiration of Scripture comes into that as well, that God has sanctified particular documents, the biblical documents, to reveal himself.
Well, there'll be a chance to continue asking questions with George over refreshments. Would you join with me again to thank him for an outstanding lecture?